This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce Mark Adams, who's the guiding teacher for A-Town Sangha. Sounds like a rock group, doesn't it? What is the town again, Mark?
Aromas.
Aromas, which is where it's...
It's actually nowhere and everywhere. It's on the road to Monterey. You're going to 101 and cut off 129 like you're going to go to Watsonville. And there's one stop sign. Town of 2200, a sweet little town, beautiful town.
Thank you for teaching us this morning. Thank you.
We always begin our time together at the A-Town Sangha, which is actually a mindfulness meditation group that just has that nickname, but we always start it by kind of settling in to where we're at. Even for those that have sat these last couple of sessions and outside, now it's a wonderful time just to gather back together. And you want to close your eyes for a minute and just kind of take a nice breath and settle in. Open up your shoulders. This is an embodied practice. And our breath and our posture are very important. And if you're ready, I think this is a group of advanced practitioners, if you're ready, if you can make a slight smile, not a false smile, but just a friendly smile. And just notice. Notice with some tenderness, as you look down maybe and you see all of us here, all of the intention, and just like you would with a dear friend that you would give a hug to, give yourself that. And then give everyone else. So the title of this talk is Wild Country Zen, The Peaceful Mountain and Subtle Way Leading to the Tiger's Cave. And it's a description in some way of my own practice, but I think there's a lot of similarities to our practice here at Jikoji. Out here in the country. I want to also begin by paying homage to my teachers. Though we have so many wonderful, I would call them prophets, modern-day prophets, who write modern-day sutras for our time, Zen is still a face-to-face transmission practice. And though it's not possible to always be sitting with other people, which is why I strongly recommend that we have a home practice. But there's no substitution for coming together like this and feeling each other's vibrations and heart beating. So I want to pay homage to Sukhitsu Norman Fisher, one of my first teachers at Green Gulch. Eco Carolyn Atkinson, Dharma Heir of Kobin. I sat with at Everyday Dharma Zen Center. And Shoho Michael Newhall, my guiding teacher now on my path to ordination. There's no need to memorize anything. I want to start off with that, or do anything but be present. And we have a term in Zen called the storehouse consciousness. And it's basically the idea that all of our impressions, all of our thoughts, everything we hear, all these Dharma talks, all of the sesshins, all of the interactions that we have are stored in this kind of substratum of a consciousness. They're like planted like seeds that will ripen in their own time, and over time you see the results. In karmic action, in what we do. I wanted to start off just by thinking about the meaning of these words. In some ways, Zen can never be expressed. It's inexpressible. And that, to me, is a wonderful analogy for my experience on this planet. I can't completely understand. Maybe completely shouldn't even be there. But I can be present with this, and I can use words because it's what we have available to us. There's that common expression of the finger pointing to the moon, so make no mistake that finger, these words, are the moon. That can only be experience, but it's what we have to work with. The word wild is often associated with something unruly, undisciplined, usually in a negative way, or often is. But in this sense, obviously, that's not the meaning that I think of when I think of wild country Zen. I think of our interface between this human-built world that we have, and then two steps out from here in this magical place, the wild. It's not Disneyland. It's the home of 1,000 dramas playing out. And it's beautiful, and it's terrifying at times. And I think it's a wonderful place to practice, in addition to our work, to our practice on the cushion. So I mean wild in that sense. And then country, for me, has the connotation of a more spacious way of living. Maybe not simpler in our case. But more spacious and kind of allowing, understanding, allowing nature to be as it is. What we might call the external nature and our own internal nature. That's why it's such a great practice companion, to see nature, to be with nature. Of course, everything is nature, Tokyo, New York, in one sense. It's natural, as we are. But this kind of nature, to me is the closest analogy to that moment of presence, when for a moment I'm able to not quite be looking through those thick lenses of ego, and just what is. When you go out today, after, be sure to look up. Our practice here is a concentration practice in which we look down, for very good reason. We start off like that. We come in with all of the lists and all of the worries, sometimes bringing in a heartache so bad that we can barely stand it. And we gather together and focus for a moment and breathe, use our breath. Very simple things that I love about our practice. So Zen, for those of you that are not practitioners, and I want to thank everyone that's come here today who may not be Zen practitioners. It's a Japanese school of Mahayana Buddhism. And it emphasizes meditation and also intuition. This is the part that's not often emphasized in the way it's described. But the word intuition means the ability to understand something immediately without any need of conscious thinking about, oh, that makes sense. It's the acceptance of so many parts of things that are unknown and unknowable. That honesty is something that's very attractive to me in Zen, unknowable. Although there's some writings about an afterlife or about how we are, some words may be used for reincarnation and things throughout the sutras. From my understanding of Zen, that idea is put on the shelf, on the side, as being unknowable. But that doesn't mean that you can't make it something if you feel that. You can't make it your own. That's the other thing. Sounds like I'm being an evangelist here for Zen, but Zen needs no evangelists, and it really doesn't evangelize. But the thing I love about it is it acknowledges those things that we can't know, but allows, and that word is crucial, I think, allows us to find our own way within the forms. It also gives us, I think, the possibility of a step towards a deep ecology that includes everything. That's why I call it a deep ecology. And deep beauty. That beauty includes the thousand dramas that are going on every day in our life, around us, that we read, that we see, that tear the heart out of us, and that go on out here in this, what we call beauty. Beauty includes all of it. And from my understanding of Zen, that is what is included. It's the thing that gives us the ability to perceive beauty. You might say we come with this diagnosis of an over-conditioned mind, with so much available to us, so many wisdom traditions and so many possibilities. Like, what do they call that? The It's the problem of too much. So we try to simplify it here with our forms. So you don't have to wonder what it is you're going to do. You can drop all of that. When I walk in that door, and I put my hands together in gassho, over my heart, this beautiful, and it's a common practice among so many religions, maybe all. I'm bringing together my energy and my focus, and my body is remembering that. I know there's not a separation of body and mind, but just for our sake of a talk, it's visceral. And this is why in so many countries that I have visited, maybe you have, and come from, that feeling of being viscerally connected to a religion or a practice is just there. It doesn't have to be learned, it doesn't come out of books. It's ingrained in everything, everything you do. And that's how it's becoming for me when I can bring my attention back to this, just like I do in meditation. Those delicious stories come back to this present moment. So the wild country Zen that I talk about is really one that acknowledges that we are part of this wild ecology that includes all of it. And in this particular place of Jikoji, we have the opportunity almost immediately after having a nice meal be able to stop out there. I recommend when you go, at least sometimes go alone. Or if you go with someone, don't talk. Not the entire way necessarily, but for some portion of it. It's kind of a requirement. We recently had a sesshin here at Jikoji called the Nature Sesshin. Marvelous sesshin led by Eric Remington and Doug. And in that we went out and we paused. And we brought that back down when we came and sat. This is available wherever we are. Just walking outside. If you have a garden, or if a neighbor has a garden, and appreciating it. And that's part of that deep beauty, that appreciation, that aesthetic of mindfulness. It's an important form. The forms are not rules. They're not commandments. They're not mitzvahs. What they are is just the nature of our practice, as Koban called it. It's the nature of our practice. It's the container in which when we walk in, we don't have to wonder, what do I do with my hands? How do I go? We can drop all of that once we know that. And make that silent transition for however long we have. To bring our awareness to this moment. That's our exercise. That's our gym. That's our fitness plan. Different kind of fitness. It doesn't last forever, so it's the intention is not to sit and be just the perfect sitter and be able to sit continually. Because the other part of the Mahayana tradition is the Bodhisattva ideal, which is stepping into service. And the story is, to me, a really beautiful but gut-wrenching one. Avalokiteshvara has done all the things required to reach nirvana, this cessation of our life in this samsara of birth and death and troubled world of suffering and unfairness. And right at the gate, she hears a baby cry. That's not the only baby. That's just the baby she heard. She knows. I can only imagine that feeling of her at that gate, turning around, and the really difficult part is knowing, even if she turns around, it's not going to be enough. That's one baby. How many can even Avalokiteshvara say? And yet, and this is the beauty again of our practice, what did we chant this morning but the impossible bodhisattva vows? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. So, kind of a high bar. Delusions rise inexhaustibly, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates, all the different possible paths, open endlessly, I vow to enter them all. And finally, the Buddha way is unsurpassable, impossible, and I vow to become it. That was Avalokiteshvara's mantra as she turned around. It's our mantra too. And it's not particular to Zen. In every tradition there are, and in no tradition, in the secular world, just wonderful. I would still call them, because it's through my lens, bodhisattvas, who are willing to take that gut-wrenching turn to be in the mud and the blood. The other thing about it is, it'd be less of a problem if it was so clear what needs to be done. Oh, I'm going to be a bodhisattva, I'm going to do the right thing, I'm going to make sure that I help everyone, and it's going to be great. But as every parent knows, as every friend knows, as every partner knows, can't really know what is right all the time, or even maybe very often. What is the right thing? What is the helpful thing? Even with that intention. And that's where the practice comes back again. Our practice is like a three-legged stool. Say, Zen is like that. And it includes the meditation and the forms. Also includes an exploration of virtues. And these are done through something called the Jukai process. The process isn't the word, but it's done through Jukai, which is the receiving of the precepts. Where you sow a rock soup, itself an excellent analogy to how life is, because it's sewn by hand. The stitches are uneven. You're always wondering, at least I am, is that good enough, or do I pull that back and start over? What difference does it make? And yet through that process of Namokibutsu, I'm following in this Buddhist path, a life is stitched together. It's a wonderful poem. I have brought today four wonderful poets with me. Can't see them, but they're with me. This one is by my friend Scott Bader. It's worth it going inside. It mends a torn life, sews the pieces together more beautifully than if they'd never been apart. It's impossible to know this, being in pieces, and lacking instruction, and stitching practice. But for new beginnings, delusions tear inexhaustibly. So humbly consider. Practice lights the candle. Buddha threads the needle. Dharma guides that thread through the cloth that is the Sangha. And the tailor begins again. Thank you, Scott, for letting me read that. So we have to make this practice our own, and that is a beautiful thing. And terrifying. Are we doing it right? Is it enough? How much sitting? When? What should we do? And so we sit. For our guided meditations that we do in Aromas, I actually use a bit of mindfulness vipassana to start off with. I use the analogy of a sewing machine, washing machine. It's on the agitation cycle, interestingly named. But that's what our life is, really, right? We've got to work with this. Some agitation, but the effect of working with it is better than not. But at that point, we put it on the soak cycle. At some point, we put it on the soak cycle. And all of that that has come off of there, if we're patient, settles. And when it settles, things are revealed that have always been there. And to me, that's the lesson when it said that what Buddhism is about is not teaching you something new. It's revealing something that's already there. That may reveal something, and it may not, which is why we're always told, don't have that as the intention. I'm sitting because I want some nice, juicy insights. I'm counting on that. There's something about that that makes it more difficult. And that is called grasping. We have these concepts that they fit one to another, like a rakusu. Clinging and grasping, wanting what is good, wanting what feels great. And aversion to the things that we don't want. Now these are life skills. We have to have them. But they're not always the wisest. It's not always the wisest to do the easy thing. Hence Avalokiteshvara's choice. So we come back to practice and we sit with restraint and we follow our breath and we settle, and from that we allow and we stop at allowing. But allowing will come in so handy as we walk this path, this veil of tears. Another poem I want to read, if you'll indulge me. I love poetry. This is by Dana Faulds, which I've read at our meeting, and it's called Allow. There is no controlling life. Try corralling a lightning bolt, containing a tornado. Dam a stream and it will create a new channel. Resist and the tide will sweep you right off your feet. Allow and grace will carry you to higher ground. The only safety lies in letting it all in. The wild with the weak. Fear, fantasies, failures and success. And when loss rips the doors off of your heart, or sadness veils your vision with despair, practice becomes simply bearing the truth. But in that choice to let go of the known way of being, the whole world is revealed to your new eyes. Thank you, Dana, for writing that poem. Just as a side tip, there's always at least one thing you should get out of a Dharma talk, if nothing else. Nothing is remembered. Some tip that when somebody says, oh, so how was it? Oh, it was good. And then you search for, oh, it was, yeah, there was something, yeah, it's one thing. If you want to be happier, spend more time dwelling on something when it is good, when something good happens to you. Don't say, oh yeah, that's really nice. But you know the problem. We've become experts in the ability to find problems, but spend more time with that. Hold it. Savor it. If someone has given you something, really look them in the eye and thank them for that. These are unbelievable moments in our lives, the best moments of our lives. There's nothing else really more important. But it takes restraint, and the reason is because we have 100 other things we can be doing at any once. And that puts terrible fear in some ways. Is this the optimal way? Am I doing, is this the best way I could spend my limited time on this earth? Yes, the best way is to give your friend a hug, thank them for being with you, for walking a path with you, for sharing things with you. That's a practice. It's a practice we can do. It doesn't require any organization. The last part of our meditation and the Eitan Sangha, which I love, is a form of Shikantaza. I consider there to be several forms of Shikantaza from what I've read. Different people have different ways. Some call it even a concentration practice. Some call it placing their attention in a certain position. Some of them call it a receptive practice. However it's noted, I see two that I practice. The pure practice is to just sit. It's Dogen's instruction. Couldn't be easier in terms of instruction and more difficult in terms of practice. Just sit. See what arises. No instruction. I've heard it explained that this is the way that someone who's sitting gets to the top of the mountain. And that to me comes under the category of unknown. But in any event, sit. And that's sometimes my practice. But other times, I have a practice that I'd call not now. And you might have other words for it. But it's not a concentration practice where I'm focusing, which I think is wonderful to come first when you have a busy mind, when you're making the transition, counting your breaths, body scan. But it's now coming up to the surface of this vast ocean of consciousness. And as a thought arises, just very gently, as you would with a small child, not now, not now. Why can't you do this? Why can't you listen? How many times have I told that little devil and angel on our shoulders, at least on mine? But rather, no, not now. This is the time for this. I'm going to have a lot of time for that story. And then there's also the times when I do want to work with something. I want to noodle on it a bit. There's something really bothering me. This is my practice. Somebody told me this once at Green Gulch. I did residential practice at Green Gulch. In fact, Norman, that's where I had Norman Fisher as my teacher. And I was outside sitting with one of the practice members, and I said, you know, I don't like some of this. It feels a little bit like we have original sin. You know, like I vow beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion, and boy, that sounds... I remember that from Catholic school. The original sin that I need to suffer for. And this very wise fellow practitioner looked at me and said, you know, you can make this your own. There's nobody saying, ah, I saw that thought in there. Stick out your hand. It's not going to happen. It's yours. You decide how you practice. Within the forms, though, like an improv theater, there are certain requirements. Zen is very much like improv theater, for those of you that might have done it. See if you agree with me. There's no rules, except the rules are, if somebody suggests that this is a sword, you don't say, no, that's not. Because then it precludes the ability of all of us working with this. In the same way, the forms allow us all to have this common experience within which we can express our complete individualness. That's how I view the peaceful mountain of practice. How much time do we have? I forget.
About 10 minutes to the lunch bell will ring.
Okay. I'll have to leave a lot of this for another time. So, Wild Country Zen, the peaceful mountain within which all the dramas occur, just like our life, but peaceful for the most part, loving that, but with a subtle way. And the subtle way, you've probably heard this in some of the sutras, a hair's breadth difference to one side. They call that the razor's edge. And you fall off. Just a slight change and you fall off. And our struggle, our practice, is to come on to that razor's edge, which is kind of an impossible thing to do. To balance these paradoxes that actually are the foundation of our life. Nothing comes without its opposite. It's the yin-yang symbol. It's the Taoist understanding of a dot of black inside of white, a dot of white inside of black. Probably the most obvious one for me, you might call it the shadow, is loss. Loss to me is the shadow of love, not hate. It's loss. Always with me, the greater I love, the greater will be my experience of loss. How can you live with that? How can we live with that? It's not possible to live with that. But that, to me, is my experience. So you have the option of following to the letter the idea of no attachment. Ah. Do the mental gymnastics of how you love someone without having any attachment to them. Perhaps it is possible for a Buddha, and I'm speaking out of turn. But for me, I am attached. And I'm hoping that it's a more subtle understanding of attached than black and white. And that it has to do with not attaching to the requirement that I be continually entertained. Not attaching to continually rejecting people. When I feel the suffering that they're imposing on others, it's probably my hardest and most difficult edge of my practice. So that subtle way has to do with this process. I liken it to how a beach is built during the winter. During the winter, you know, the waves have come, you've been through hell, and there's a lot of rocks. And then over time, the waves come and they bring a few bits of sand, and then it rolls back, and oh, it's less. Oh, no, wait a minute. Oh, it's more. And by summertime, there can be a beach rebuilt. And that's what I see with this practice coming back to. Even in those times when I've been gutted and I don't know how to go on or if or why. To come back to a practice in which I can sit and breathe without any solution, without knowing and recognizing it's unknowable. We had this little mantra that we did at Green Gulch. Some of you may know it. It said, my peace is in letting go. My strength is in giving up. And my joy is in mindfulness. That second one is a bit of a koan. My strength is in giving up. I'm not going to have an answer to that. That's a koan. And finally, this subtle path, this wild country Zen, through the peaceful mountain, on the Bodhisattva path, leads to the tiger's cave. Why? Who wants to go there? Isn't there a better route? What is the tiger? It's so beautiful. But the tiger is going to be what tiger nature is. You know, there's that idea that we are Buddha nature. All things have Buddha nature. What's the nature of the tiger? Can the tiger be something different? All kinds of things are the tiger to me. Scary things. Scary and beautiful. And when we come to that tiger's cave and we're at that gate, we have to make a decision. Do we go in or do we look for a peaceful path? Paradox again. You want to find peace? Do you think the peaceful path is the Bodhisattva? I don't see how, unless again they are already a Buddha, and maybe that's what I'm missing. I think the Bodhisattvas take it in the gut and every day wonder how they're going to go on. So you get to that cave, but you don't know if the tiger's in there at this time. The tiger goes out. You go in. It's the willingness. I think more than anything, because who knows if the Bodhisattva is really making a difference. And by our good acts, if we're actually helping, sometimes it seems like I'm enabling. I don't know. There's a long run. I'm going to have to wait to see. But it's that willingness to accept that. They call that the mud and the blood, by the way. Are you willing to get in the mud and the blood? It's not hard to be a Bodhisattva when you have a real clear decision to make. You're willing to get in that mud and the blood where you don't know exactly which direction this is going to go. And it, by saying something, you might cause it to go worse. By not saying something, you might have stepped back from a responsibility. That's really the parent's dilemma, isn't it? Those of you that are parents. It's also one of a friendship. So we go into that tiger's cave. Not as tiger tamers. None of this is going to prepare us when that time comes, when we meet the tiger. Not going to be a protective mudra. At least not always. So we go in to stroke the tiger's whiskers. I think Eric would love that. I wish he was here. Eric Remington, our wonderful teacher here, one of our wonderful teachers here. We stroke its whiskers. I know, impossible. So now we have a few minutes. I want to thank you very much for being so patient and listening to this. And we have a few, this is called Mondo, question and answer. If anyone has a question, we'll do some short things. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for your talk, by the way. It's really wonderful to be practicing with you and to experience this expression of your practice and sharing with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah. The poem that you read that had loss in it, sadness and loss, I'm wondering if I can hear it again because it struck me so poignantly.
If I can read two poems.
Yeah.
I'm going to read aloud, but I want to read Eric's poem. We have here at Jikoji an incredible poet that ties together practice and the wild. But I'll read this for you again.
Read.
Wait, there's food. All that practice. There is no controlling life. Try corralling a lightning bolt or containing a tornado. Dam a stream and it will create a new channel. Resist and the tide will sweep you right off your feet. Allow and grace will carry you to higher ground. The only safety lies in letting it all in. The wild with the weak. Fear, fantasies, failures, successes. And when loss rips the doors off of the heart and sadness veils your vision with despair, practice becomes simply bearing the truth. Now I'll complete this with Eric's wonderful poem. He just published a book called The Soft Rain of Solitude. It's a beautiful title. About aloneness, too. I'm enjoying being one-on-one with this little stream. I smell her scents, and she has many. I hear her voices and what she gossips about. I see how she moves, her smoothness. I walk in her shoes. There is always the hope to meet a stream person to person. It takes time to get connected. Each stream has its own personality. No two are the same, not even 2 days in a row. I take what I'm doing seriously. If one doesn't make a connection of the heart with a stream, one might as well just stay at home and see a stream movie or read about beautiful Bay Area nature. A vague impersonal idea of stream has no water. You have to taste it, to feel for it. You can't love an idea of a stream. I tell myself if you want to contribute to solving environmental problems like stream pollution, there has to be a reverence for nature, but my nature. There has to be an emotional connection. Knowledge and information are not enough. A nature trail is not enough. So I am asking myself, how does love happen? Thank you, Eric.
Perhaps in Gosho again. May our attentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.